Well, we just talked about historical writing from a non-fiction standpoint in our first half today. Now we'll turn to the art of writing historical fiction, which appears to be gaining a whole lot of popularity. We'll talk to a couple of practitioners of the craft. Michael Pritchett is Associate Professor of English Language and Literature at UMKC and author of The Melancholy Fate of Captain Lewis. Michael, welcome.
Thank you,
Steve.
Nice to have you. Great to be here.
Tom Averill is author of Road. He is writer in residence and an English professor at Washburn U over in Topeka. Tom, nice to have you, too.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And I should point out, both are speaking at the Mark Twain Writers Workshop. That's a 30-year Kansas City tradition at UMKC. More information about the workshops on our website, kcur.org. Well, Michael, what's the advantage of writing historical fiction? Why not write historical nonfiction?
I would say that historical fiction is the one area of writing that sort of allows you to go back and study the origin of an idea. For instance, if you're really fascinated by a particular idea and where does that idea originally enter the culture, mm-hmm. Historical writing is the thing that I sort of picked as my medium for doing that.
You know, Tom, some folks might think you're substituting sugar for broccoli, in a sense. You're not giving people the real good stuff.
Well, you are and you aren't. I think the interesting thing about writing historical fiction is that the past is always in the present now. And if you're writing about now, you're writing about the past. And if you're writing about the past, you're writing about now,
mm-hmm.
On some level. So sugar and broccoli have always been together,
mm-hmm.
in some way. I used as an epigraph for my book a quote from Joseph Stanley Pennell. It was, "There are no dreams of now that were not then." And that expresses that sense of the now and the then,
yeah,
being very much alike. And exploring the then-ness and the now-ness was part of what interested me in my book.
Well, hang with me just for a minute more, Michael, because you're talking to a journalist here who writes about exactly what happens, at least in theory. You know, part of what you wind up writing is true. Part of what you wind up writing is not. So where does that leave the reader?
I think that the reader has to basically trust you. They have to believe that your desire is to show them history, the past, in a way that they really ought to try looking at it,
mm-hmm.
That maybe they have looked at it in a way that is not entirely accurate, and that maybe if we look at this event again with the perspective that we have on it now, maybe it will look different and maybe we will feel differently about it.
I guess what I'm wondering is how does the reader know what's accurate and what actually happened and what didn't and what's a product of the imagination?
With my own writing, I really feel like I cannot make up entire events. So when a reader's reading me, for the most part, they're reading things that that we have some documentation that this is basically what occurred.
Mm-hmm.
So they know that I'm not making up whole events.
So there are ethical lines here that exist in your world, right?
Yes.
You can only go so far.
Yes, for me there are.
How about you, Tom?
Well, I was writing about a period of 1825, and I was basing my novel on a song by Jimmy Driftwood.
That's right.
The Tennessee Stud. And because of that, I had very little factual plot to go on. I did research it very thoroughly, and I did find out that the story that Jimmy Driftwood was telling that happened along about 1825 was something that had happened to his wife's grandfather's grandfather. And so it was a family story that had come down. So my responsibility was to make up that story and to detail it in a way that it would make sense to the reader. And
so it's based on based on something solid and secure.
It's based on a family story, and it's based on America of 1825.
Mm-hmm.
So my job was to research that thoroughly and to not make mistakes.
And there's no question that this type of literature is gaining in popularity. Why?
I think people are fascinated with where we came from. I think as we examine where we're going, the need to know really what America really was. Mm-hmm. For example, in 1825.
Which is what Dorothy Wickenden just said in our first half.
Yeah, my hero is traveling from Tennessee down through Arkansas Territory into what would become Texas, down into Mexico. He runs into French traders. He runs into Native Americans. He runs into an incredible amount of diversity, the Spanish around San Antonio and their presence, and the number of cultures that were alive and important to the formation of the United States during that time is incredible. And we act like it all happened at Plymouth Rock when there were Spaniards in Kansas in 1541 before Plymouth Rock. So understanding the truth about a place, that's what I was most interested in.
Michael, what's your theory about why historical fiction is gaining strength, it seems, by the year?
I think if you look back at the beginning of the 20th century, what happens in the sort of the first part of that century is a real sort of complete retooling of the American style and the American voice. And you have a style emerging at that point mm-hmm. that is completely different from how we viewed ourselves and how we thought of ourselves prior to that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that now that we're at the beginning of a new century and basically at about the same point that we were back then, I think that we're looking forward to that century and saying to ourselves, okay, let's review.
Mm-hmm.
Let's look back and see exactly what the 20th century was. Let's look at the 19th century again, and let's decide, do we want to go forward thinking of ourselves the way that we have, or do we want to reevaluate and start trying to think of ourselves in a new way?
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date. We're talking about the rise of historical fiction this morning with Michael Pritchett, who's an associate professor of English language and literature over at UMKC, and Tom Averill, author of Road. He's a writer in residence and an English prof at Washburn University in Topeka. You know, what are some of the best known examples from recent years? Obviously, each of you have your own books, Tom, but what are some other big bestsellers that maybe people might recognize from the titles themselves?
Well, I remember when I was very first an undergraduate at University of Kansas, and I had an opportunity to meet Thomas Berger, who wrote Little Big Man, which is one of my favorite Westerns. And he said at one point that he spent a year reading all of the history and lore of the West that he could get hold of. And then he put everything aside, took no notes, and wrote Little Big Man. I still think Little Big Man is one of the great Westerns that's ever been written and one of the great historical novels. Then you take someone like Jane Smiley, who wrote The All True Travels and Adventures of Liddy Newton, set in Lawrence, Kansas in 1856, around that time. It's the main period. And she researched very thoroughly and took great notes. I remember one reviewer saying, it's a great historical novel. I just wish she hadn't included so much of her historical research in it. And that's the difference between writing fact and writing fiction, and that interplay.
It's easy to go overboard,
yeah.
I'm sure.
And I think that's one thing that Michael does so well in The Melancholy Fate. It's just the Lewis and Clark trip is there, but it's a very human story. It's not, you know, it's not mm-hmm. just redoing the Lewis and Clark adventure. It's a human story, and there are just enough details to evoke it and not too many to make you think, oh, I'm reading all of Michael's research.
I was going to say, Michael, how tempting is it to sort of show off to the reader that you've studied all this stuff and you've taken all these copious notes and you want to show the world that, hey, you know what you're talking about?
Yeah, it's very tempting, particularly with Lewis and Clark, because you can read pretty much everything that exists, all of the primary documents, and you have all of those facts at your fingertips, and a lot of them are just fabulous. I mean, you want to include those thousands of little details. But I rewrite my manuscript generally several times from end to end when I'm working on a book. And gradually, sort of a few hundred at a time, I take the details that I know are getting in the way out. Mm-hmm. And it's hard, but you do it. And I've developed, kind of a methodical process for getting them out.
Well, the rewriting, that's the tough stuff, isn't it? I mean, that's where the rubber really hits the road when it comes to the exercise of writing itself, right?
Yes. I mean, mm-hmm. it's the rewriting is basically trying to completely revision the book. and see it, try to see it exactly as you think that it could be, as opposed to how it looks on the page at that moment.
Is there an example of historical fiction that you think sort of is at the top of the heap when it comes to a great example of it?
I think that the historical fiction that's been done by I don't know, the people that I always find myself wanting to talk about are the probably the Wuthering Heights by Bronte is a great one. Billy Budd by Herman Melville is a great one. I think that that Ron Hansen, a more contemporary example, his book Marriott in Ecstasy, was fairly recent and was very good.
We have another example here from Joe from Shawnee, who's got a great example, I think. Joe, good morning.
Yeah, you were asking earlier for some great examples of historical fiction.
That's right.
And I'd like to go back to Steinbeck, specifically to Grapes of Wrath, but Cannery Row, et cetera. I think we're all based upon actual historical events with slightly fictionized, and I was just wondering if I could get your guest comments on Steinbeck.
Oh, boy, what a great example. Glad you called, Joe. Tom, what do you think?
I love John Steinbeck.
Boy, I do, too.
I grew up reading him all through high school, read everything he wrote. And then when I got to college, they said, oh, we don't read Steinbeck in college.
What's that about?
He only won the Nobel Prize.
Yeah.
I like to see when people go back and read East of Eden again and Grapes of Wrath again. He's a brilliant writer and a very human being.
So you would consider that a great example of historical fiction, then?
I would, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Michael, you said that the basic impulse of the historical writer is to retell stories we think we know already. Why is that the basic impulse? Where does that come from? What's the point there?
I think that when we learn history and when we learn stories, particularly when we see those stories dramatized and put into movies, in particular Hollywood movies, we look at the way that the characters are acting and how they're acting in relation to the events that they're part of. And I think as a writer, I look at them and think, I don't really believe you feel that, would have felt that way about this situation. I think that actually this historical event would have been much more upsetting to you. You would not have felt that you were in the midst of a wonderful romantic saga, but you would actually be somewhat horrified by what was going on around you.
Yeah. Tom, there's another trend these days, which is how historical writing is being used by some of the most out there avant-garde, postmodern, and science fiction writers. What's going on with that?
I'm not really sure what's going on.
Yeah.
I mean,
happening, though.
I think when you've got something like Cowboys and Aliens at the movie or something like that, you're blending we've always had a fascination with futuristic writing, too.
Mm-hmm.
So this notion of blending the futuristic writing and the past writing about the past is interesting to me because it's the same impulse,
yeah.
I think. It's exploring the then is in the future, just like the then is in the past.
Michael, you're seeing a lot of that going on these days, too?
Yes. I just taught Cormac McCarthy's novel, Blood Meridian, and I taught it mostly because my students kept raving about it and saying how great it was. And I
remind us what it's about.
It's basically a retelling of what was going on around the border in the early part of the 19th century regarding who was going to control that border from the standpoint of Mexico, the Indian tribes, and this very young American nation. And I picked it up expecting it to be a historical novel, and actually it's a very postmodern novel. It's got very little actual historical event in it, but it's got a tremendous amount of horror and horrific occurrence, and the characters around these occurrences behaving in really horrific, inhuman ways. And that's something that you tend to see not in historical fiction but in postmodern fiction.
There's also, as you point out, something of an obsession with the 19th century. Why the 19th century?
I think the 19th century is when we is a time that we look back on and think of it as sort of an ideal, that there were that life was gentler in some ways, slower, kinder, more humane. And as a writer, I think that those kinds of ideas, whenever mm-hmm. I run across them, it really makes me want to attack, because I think that the 19th century was probably not at all the romantic kind of a place that even the literature of that time did attempt to cast it in a romantic light, and I don't think that that's what the historical record really supports.
Tom, is there any chance that we're overdoing the 1800s?
Oh, I don't see how you could overdo the 1800s. It's such a mm-hmm. fascinating period. And I agree with Michael that you have all this mythology that has to do with the 1800s, the cowboy of the West, the freedoms, the don't fence me in. And yet, as Michael's book points out, once you go into a new territory, it's no longer the same territory. It'll never be the same again. Mm-hmm. So discovery is loss, and freedom is loneliness, and settling down is what the American story is all about. And sort of coming to grips with that, I think, that's a big part of Michael's book, and it's a big part of mine too. Hmm.
Michael, tell us a little more about your book, The Melancholy Fate of Captain Lewis. So what's the arc of the story? Where does the book go?
It is a split narrative. So there's both a contemporary character, a guy named Bill Lewis, and then there is the historic Meriwether Lewis. Mm-hmm. They're living 200 years apart from each other in time. They just happen to have the same name. But Bill Lewis's experience in the modern world is intentionally paralleling Lewis's in the 19th century.
In what sense?
In the sense that Meriwether Lewis is on this great adventure, where he is crossing the United States and coming back again, and Bill is spending a lot of time driving around town in his car. He's running a lot of errands. He's embroiled in all kinds of dramas that are the kinds of dramas that we are each embroiled in our own modern lives.
Like what kinds of dramas?
Dramas regarding marriage, dramas regarding the depression that Bill suffers from, dramas regarding his job and the students that he gets sort of overly involved in their emotional lives.
And so the point of making the connection between a contemporary Lewis and a past Lewis is what?
The real purpose there was, on my part, to explore melancholia and to look at where the idea of depression and melancholy comes from. What was it like in the 19th century?
Because Meriwether Lewis suffered from it in a profound way, right?
He did. Mm-hmm. He did, and probably contributed to his death.
Mm-hmm.
And so where does that idea come from? How did we think of it? What did we do about it as compared to how we think about it and what we're doing about it now?
Yeah. And Tom, your book, Road, take us there.
Well, it's based on the song by Jimmy Driftwood, mm-hmm. Tennessee Stud, and it's basically a book about a young man who falls in love and then has some trouble with his sweetheart's brothers and pa. And so he has to take a journey. And it's a very American story, a man who's slightly a fugitive, slightly an adventurer, coming clear down into Mexico where he ends up killing a gambler. And so he sort of becomes what he's running from, and he needs to go back and claim what he thinks is his. So it's got courtship in it. It's got the adventure fugitive. It's got the kind of showdown element. And then it's got that great American settling down in the new territories because they go then from Tennessee to Arkansas.
Was it a hard book to write?
It was a fun book to write. It's always hard to write a book, but it was great fun. I traveled the whole route of the thing. I'm very interested in landscape and the way in which it changes and doesn't change for mm-hmm. my characters. Very interested in a young man's sort of forced development. Mm-hmm. You know, here's a guy who grows up in rural Tennessee, and suddenly he falls in love and he's disconnected. He's like, he has to do a 9-month sabbatical somewhere to discover who he is. And it's so in that way, it's also a kind of coming of age for the man. I made the guy born on the day that the Louisiana Purchase was made, because he goes and explores that same kind of territory himself.
So when historical novelists get together, they talk about what, Michael?
I would say we generally talk about what we're doing to our houses.
because the houses. Yeah.
Because I think it's hard to talk shop with another historical novelist to the degree that I think that you get hooked on some particular area or time and place. For reasons that are generally fairly personal ones, mm-hmm. and they're hard to sort of share with somebody else. So for the most part, it's hard to really get down to the nuts and bolts of why you're working on a particular book.
You know, this Mark Twain Writers Workshop has been in existence for nearly 3 decades. Tell us about it. What happens?
Basically, it's a very unique writing workshop experience. It's mm-hmm. open to all creative writers. We get beginners, we get experts, we get people who are published and unpublished, and we throw them all in together, and they have an opportunity to have contact with a kind of writer in various disciplines. And so there's the opportunity basically to study a lot of different things, masters, disciplines.
And it takes place when?
It's taking place starting on Monday, and it runs from the June 4th to June 22nd. So please come sign up. There's still room.
Okay. Again, more information about that on our website, kcur.org. Michael Pritchett, so good to have you here.
Thank you, Steve.
Tom Averill, thanks so much to your time, for your time as well, too. I sure appreciate
it. Thank you.
It.
My pleasure.
Yeah. Michael Pritchett is an associate professor of English and literature at UMKC. Tom Averill is a writer in residence and an English prof at Washburn University in Topeka. Again, more information about our program and the Mark Twain's Writers Workshop at kcur.org. Tomorrow on the program, legendary sports commentator Frank DeFord talks about his new memoir, Overtime, My Life as a Sports Writer, and we'll get our weekend to-do list from Brian McTavish. The show is produced by Steven Steigman. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.